think we're here. Those probably who are coming, some may drift in late. We might as well begin. I think I know almost all of you. I'm Frank Clooney, Academic Director, and I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon, Thursday afternoon seminar with Professor Nick Allen. I've discovered in thinking of introducing Professor today that he and I have certain things in common. We both began with work in classics. I did undergraduate studies in classics before moving on to theology and the study of India, and Nick took a similar path that he may mention to us. We both have a Nepal connection, Kathmandu connection. Much of Professor Allen's earliest work has to do with ethnographic studies in Nepal, and I had spent some time there teaching after college, so we have that connection as well. And then Professor Allen is a great Indo-Europeanist and comparativist, and I'm a Jesuit, and part of the Jesuit tradition was, right from the 16th century on, to make connections and draw analogies between the study of India and also the study of China and the study of Native Americans with the patterns of thought in the Greek and Roman world. And there are very elaborate charts and books from the 17th, 18th century trying to show the parallels in structure and parallels in the myths and so on between the two. So I feel very comfortable with Professor Allen being here today. And but that's where the comparison ends, because he's actually gone on to do this very well, the Indo-European connection. And I was just going through OLIS this morning just to pull out for you some of the titles that show that Nick, if I may call you Nick, has done this thing very well. Arjuna and Odysseus, debating Dumézil. Dumézil was the great scholar of Indo-European studies in the last century. Debating Dumézil, recent studies in comparative mythology. Hinduism, structuralism, and Dumézil. Homer's simile, Vyasa's story. The Indo-European prehistory of yoga. Varnas, colors, and functions, expanding Dumézil's schema. Arjuna and the second function. Argos and Hanuman, Odysseus's dog in the light of the Mahabharata. Scripture and Epic, a comparativist looks at the biography of the Buddha. Athena and Durga, warrior goddesses in Greek and Sanskrit epic. Penelope and Draupadi, the validity of the comparison. And Mahabharata and Iliad, a common origin, ? So Professor Allen, Nick, is extremely advanced in this field, perhaps the world expert in this kind of comparative work. And we'll be speaking today on yet another such comparison, the importance of Bhishma for Indo-European cultural comparison.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. We're a smallish group, so do interrupt if I'm obscure at any point. There's quite a lot to get through. I hope everyone's got the handout. What I really like is getting into the details, the solid facts, but I need a bit of theory, I suppose, to begin with, and probably... if you haven't met this before, I need to say a little bit about Indo-European cultural comparativism as an undertaking. It is, of course, based fair and square and solidly on the work of the linguists. The notion of Indo-European is a linguist's notion, and it's one that we students of culture derive from them quite explicitly and overtly. And just as the aim of the comparative Indo-European linguists is to contribute to the history of language, that applies exactly to the cultural comparativist too. Just as the linguist shows that, let's say, a Sanskrit and a Latin and a Germanic root all go back to a proto-Indo-European one, the cultural comparativist hopes to show that perhaps a myth or a particular character or a pattern of ideas or an institution, an invocation, goes back to a feature of the proto-culture. So we very much pattern our activities on the linguists. But when I talk of proto-language or proto-culture, what do I mean in concrete terms? Is it just an abstraction that results from the process of comparison itself, or is it something that existed in real time and space? Unfortunately, it's very hard to answer this, and the linguists have been arguing about it solidly for centuries, with the help of archaeologists, of course, and haven't come up with a definitive conclusion, and I can't offer one either. I suppose the commonest view is that Proto-Indo-European was spoken in a reasonably confined area in the south of Russia, that is north of the Black Sea and the Caspian, about 3,500 BC, something of that order. But there are lots of variant theories, and some people would put the location of the Proto-Indo-European speakers south of the Black Sea, some would put it right over towards the Aral Sea, and so on. So I leave that open. How does one go about it? Well, one confines, in the first instance, one confines attention to the Indo-European speaking world, and probably most profitably to the more traditional and ancient parts of that world, that is the ones for which we have data from an early period. I'm not saying that later materials can't be used, but it makes sense to concentrate on the earliest materials when they're available. And it's not enough just to find an isolated similarity between, let's say, a Latin or a Greek phenomenon and a Greek one and a Sanskrit one. What one wants is networks, is whole sets of phenomena that match. And this is absolutely important, because you can find isolated similarities between almost any two cultures across the face of the globe, and that's not going to tell you anything about the history if they're just isolated. It's when you're dealing with complex structures of ideas that you're onto something worthwhile. So the more detailed and the more interrelated the similarities, the better. As for the history of the field, of course, people have been asking the cultural question alongside the linguistic question ever since Sir William Jones in the 1780s, but on the whole, they didn't get very far with it. And it's quite rare now to see people referring back to say Max Müller or someone like that as having discovered something useful that one can build on. On the whole, the field was refounded and has taken off from the work of Georges Dumézil, as Frank mentioned, whom I was lucky enough to meet in Paris in the early 80s, before his death in 86, a couple of times. He's best known for what is called the trifunctional theory of Indo-European ideology. This is a rather this is a phrase that needs a certain amount of unpacking, perhaps, if people haven't met it before. And I've attempted that in the article referred to at the bottom of the handout. What sort of a construct is this that Dumézil is putting forward? And I think it's best thought of as a form of classification, a way of structuring a worldview, of providing the classes into which elements of the world fall, the real world or the imaginary world, it doesn't matter. A classification then that applies to the worldview or to domains within the worldview. And when I say transgeneric, what I mean is that the same classification applies across different domains. On the whole, Westerners are perfectly familiar with this sort of phenomenon when one thinks of, let's say, Middle Ages medical theory, where different humours were associated with different seasons or with different colours or with different deities. So you're dealing with a number of different domains, which, however, are all interlinked. So the classification spans domains. And here, this sort of way of organising worldviews is not that uncommon anthropologically, and it's not particularly surprising that the Indo-Europeans should have, early Indo-Europeans should have had such a way of organising their worldview, or that over the course of millennia they should have lost it, essentially, because nowadays we don't think in these terms. His Dumézil's view was that the classification scheme used by the early Indo-European speakers was triadic, and he used the numbers 1, 2, and 3 to refer to the three classes. So one talks about first functional, second functional, and third functional entities. The reasons for word function I won't go into, but his idea was of a triadic form of classification, and these classes were hierarchized or ranked so that the first function outranked the second and the second outranked the third. More recently, I've been arguing that Dumézil had an unduly shrunken view of the classificatory system of the Indo-Europeans, and that it was in fact pentadic, and that we need to add to the three functions recognised by Dumézil, one at the top and one at the bottom, or as I prefer to say, two half classes, one at the top and one at the bottom, and I have reasons for that which aren't really relevant today. So just let's say that what I posit is a pentadic structure. So I label the classes with an F for standing for function, which is the term Dumézil uses. And I distinguish between three core functions, 1, 2, and 3, which are more or less what Dumézil already postulated, but I slightly adjust his definition of the first function. But I have these two aspects of the fourth function, one at the top end and one at the bottom end of the hierarchy. And how do I define this fourth function? I define it as pertaining to otherness, what is other, outside or beyond, relative to the core. And obviously what comes at the start of the hierarchy is valued, and what comes at the bottom of the hierarchy is devalued. So we have positively valued otherness, F4 plus at one end, and F4 minus negatively valued otherness at the other end. In the core, we have the first functional phenomena, first class, if you like, which consists of things relating to priestliness, to the law. After all, a Brahman is not only a priest, but he's someone who knows about the holy law, so I put priestly legal, and cognitive, because it pertains to knowledge and wisdom. The second function pertains to force and the use of force by soldiers or strong men, physically strong people, usually men, can be women. Third function pertains to fecundity and or wealth. Fecundity is a useful term because it brings together sexuality and large number. I mean, somebody who is fecund is sexually very active and has lots of progeny. So it tends to pertain to plurality, and that plurality sort of spills over into possessing a lot of cattle or a lot of wealth, a lot of money. So we have these three core bodies of ideas, which Of which an obvious representative that may already have struck you is the three twice-born Varanas, with the Brahman representing the first function, the Kshatriya the second, and the Vaishya the third, insofar as they deal with money and money lending and so on. And originally the Vish would have probably been concerned more with ownership of cattle. As for F4 minus, in that context, one obviously thinks of the Shudra, who are excluded relative to the twice-born. And at the top end, the argument becomes more complex, and I'll only just say rather bluntly that it can stand for the king, or it can stand for Purusha, from whom the Varanas are derived, and who represents the totality of the Varanas, just as the king represents the totality of the kingdom, in spite of objections which may occur to you. I'll be using this pentadic schema with more examples later. The Indo-European cultural comparativist doesn't confine his interests or her interests necessarily to manifestations of this pattern, but the more one works on the field, the more often one finds manifestations cropping up. They impinge on one, they force themselves on one's attention if one's attuned to looking for them. So, coming closer to the sort of core of the subject, why concentrate on Bhishma? Why is he important for Indo-European cultural comparativism? Well, of course, he's a major character in the Mahabharata, as everyone will know. And Dumézil showed mainly in his volume called Niti Epopee, Part 1, of Volume 1. I mean, he wrote a vast amount, Dumézil, and unfortunately this hasn't been translated as yet. He showed quite convincingly, I think, though it hasn't been, perhaps because it's still in French, hasn't been as widely recognised as it ought to have been, that in the Mahabharata, in the plot, in the main story of the Mahabharata, one quite often finds ideas that are clearly of Indo-European origin. Sometimes ones that are of Indo-Iranian origin, Indo-Iranian being, of course, one sub-branch of Indo-European. And one of the things that Dumézil pointed out is that the deities who incarnate in the various Mahabharata characters are deeply significant, and the previous literature hasn't on the whole given them sufficient attention. And he emphasised that Bhishma incarnates Dyaus. Now, Dyaus, as again you probably know, is a Vedic deity, but not one who receives much attention in the Rig Veda or indeed the other Vedic scriptures. His name clearly means sky or heaven, and he's very often compounded in a Dvandva compound with Prithvi, earth. He sort of appears in quite a number of the hymns, but he's very seldom given any narrative content in the Vedas, and he doesn't appear very much in ritual either. But he's of great interest to the linguistic comparativists because he's one of the rather few Sanskrit deities whose name clearly has Indo-European cognates. That's to say, Dyaus in Sanskrit is definitely cognate with Zeus in Greek and with the first syllable of Ju in Jupiter, the Pitta just being Latin pater, father. So the linguists are quite clear that the Dyaus is cognate with these gods, and there are others, the Tew in Tuesday is a Germanic cognate too. So Dios is of considerable interest because he is represented in a number of other branches of Indo-European, whereas most of the Sanskrit gods don't have cognate theonyms in other branches of Indo-European. And they reconstruct the Proto-Indo-European form as asterisk Deus. I'll just refer to him as Deus. Dumitil not only emphasized that Bhishma incarnated Deus, which is stated more than once in the Mahabharata, but explored the parallel between Deus, between Bhishma and the Norse deity Heimdall. I won't repeat the points he made, but it seemed to me quite convincing ones. And his explanation for the similarities is that Heimdall must have taken on some of the features of Deus, and that Deus gave rise to Deus, and Bhishma derives from Deus. I mean, Bhishma as incarnation of Deus has some of the features which therefore go back to Deus and are found in the Norse god Heimdall. In other papers that are in press, I've argued that it's not the connection between Bhishma and Zeus is not merely that Bhishma incarnates Deus, who is cognate with Zeus, but that there are points of similarity, for instance, in the birth story between Bhishma and Zeus. I've also pointed out that there are similarities between Bhishma and the Zeus's grandfather Uranos, which means heaven, and it seems that the two aspects of Deus have, as it were, become separated in the Greek. When I say two aspects, I mean the lexical form on the one hand and the semantic content on the other. Uranos in Greek retains the semantic content. It means heaven, whereas Zeus hardly means sky or heaven. Zeus, however, retains the lexical form. But I won't go into the Greek data, nor will I mention, nor will I go into what I've said about Sarpedon in another article in press. Sarpedon is son of Zeus and fights for the baddies, that's the Trojans, in Homer. Today I'm going to talk instead about Romulus, the founder of Rome. You might think, what is one doing comparing a figure like Romulus, who appears in histories, with a mythical character in the Mahabharata? But Dumézil showed quite clearly that all of the earliest part of Livy, well, perhaps that's an exaggeration, the great majority of the early books of Livy are mythological material of Indo-European provenance, which has been rewritten to look like history. If you read Livy or Dionysius of Halicarnassus or even Plutarch, you'll find it written as though Romulus was a historical character, as though you could, in the Loeb editions, you'll see a date even. But Dumézil showed quite clearly that even if there was such a person, his identity was fused into a mythological schema of Indo-European origin. So there's no reason why one shouldn't explore this comparison between Romulus and Bhishma. So what I'm trying to do in the book I'm working on is to reconstruct reconstruct the proto-narrative, which would have involved Deus, I think, the proto-deity and or his human form, because I suspect that even in the proto-culture, the god had some special link with a human hero, whether that was a matter of incarnation or a matter of paternity or some other link, it isn't crucial. So I say and or his human form. Of course, what I'm trying to argue is distinctly unwelcome to certain specialists. For instance, anyone who has written and published on Romulus from within the world of classics has their own theories about Romulus, which don't take account of the Indian data, and they don't want to be told that they're wrong because they don't know the Indian data. And although there aren't many people, really, I think, who've written on Bhishma, probably some Indologists might take a similar line, that that there has been a certain hostility in Indological circles to Dumézil, based, I think, on disciplinary, based partly on disciplinary territoriality, though also on the fact that because he only had three classes in his classificatory schema, some of his arguments don't work terribly well. Anyway, an anti-comparativist view is what I'm contesting. So now we can get quickly on to the biographies of the two characters. Bhishma, people probably know a good deal about. He's the son of the goddess Ganga, the Ganges, who forces her attentions on King Shantanu and has a sort of marriage with him, produces eight children, eight infants, of whom all of the first seven are immediately drowned in the river Ganges by Ganga herself, who's got a human form naturally in order to be the partner of Shantanu. These eight vasus are all these eight infants are all incarnations, or said to be incarnations of vasus, so that Bhishma, rather confusingly, is both an incarnation of Dyaus and a vasu. That's just the facts. It's slightly surprising, but there it is, because it's not usually, one wouldn't normally think of Dyaus as a vasu, but there it is. So Bhishma, the only survivor of eight incarnated vasus. Bhishma himself isn't drowned because Ganga has made an agreement with her partner that if he ever criticizes her, she'll depart. And so Shantanu has to watch seven of his infants being drowned. And they're drowned because they, being incarnated vasus, want to go back to heaven as soon as they possibly can. They don't want to be incarnated at all. They're incarnated as a result of a curse. He criticizes his wife or his partner, and so she immediately departs. And there are two versions, but one of the versions is she takes the last-born Bhishma away with her for education and brings him back. He reappears when he's a teenager, admirably educated in the Shastras and in the other requirements of a royal male. I mean, he's also good at weapons. He now becomes crown prince to Shantanu, but he... Then, as it were, it looks as though all's going smoothly and that he will inherit the throne of his father when his father dies. But his father has been a bachelor since Ganga left him, and he now suddenly falls in love with a fisher maiden called Satyavati, and Satyavati's guardian says you can't have her unless you make Satyavati's children your heirs. And Bhishma nobly says, that's all right, I'll renounce kingship. And so he renounces kingship. And then the Satyavati's guardian says, even that's not enough, because supposing you have children, they will think they're entitled to the throne and they will fight Satyavati's children. So he says, okay, that's fine, I won't marry either. So he renounces both the throne and marriage to enable his father to marry Satyavati. Then the next thing that's really important is that he arranges the marriage of Satyavati's second son, Vichitravirya, and we'll say a bit more about this later, but he goes to Benares and abducts three princesses at a Swayamvara. Unfortunately, although Vichitravirya now has wives, he actually only has two of them because the eldest is turns out already to be engaged. He doesn't have any children by her, and so when Vichitravirya dies, Bhishma arranges for Vyasa to step in and impregnate the surviving queens and produce the next generation of the royal family. That's to say Pandu, Dhritarashtra, Pandu and Vidura. So one of the important things that Bhishma does is arrange people's marriages. He does it for his father, he does it for his stepbrother, and he does it for the next generation too. But he doesn't arrange the marriages in the final generation, generation of Arjuna. Then he, what happens next? Well, he's sort of around at the court at Hastinapura, and eventually he participates with Duryodhana in the cattle raid on Matsya during the 13th year of the exile of the Pandavas. And following on from that, in a way, he fights with on the side of Duryodhana in the great battle of the Mahabharata. And of course, book 6 of the Mahabharata, the one that contains the Bhagavad Gita, is the Bhishma Parvan. It's the one where he is the marshal. After 10 days as the Kaurava marshal, he is shot down by Arjuna and Shikhandin, and he falls to the ground, but he doesn't actually hit the ground because he's got all these arrows sticking into him from all directions, and he is held off the ground by these arrows on the so-called bed of arrows. He has received from his father, owing to his nobility in renouncing the throne, he's received the gift of not dying until he decides to, and so although he's mortally wounded, he defers the moment of his death until well a couple of months after the end of the great battle. And during the weeks and months after the great battle, still lying on his bed of arrows, he issues long instructions to Yudhishthira on kingship and on Hindu doctrines in general. Then he does finally die, rejoins the Vasus in heaven. At first sight, this is nothing like Romulus. Romulus is a twin. He, as you know, probably he's paired with Remus. As we say, it's actually Romulus and Remus, but it doesn't matter, I'll say Romulus. He's a twin. His mother is a Vestal virgin called Rhea Silvia. His father is here the different versions in the Latin and Greek sources differ, possibly is Mars. Rhea Silvia's uncle, her mother's brother, has deposed the correct king and tries to get rid of the infants, the two twins, and they're exposed, they're cast adrift on a river in the communist version, but they come to land and are suckled by a wolf, a well-known statue of a wolf suckling two twins, and then they're brought up by a humble shepherd on the site of what later was to become Rome, a shepherd or herdsman. When they're teenagers, Romulus and Remus oust the usurper and restore Numitor, their grandfather, I should say grandfather. Then they decide, the twins decide to found Rome, and they have to take the auspices, and after some rather sharp practice, Romulus wins, and he claims and persuades others that he has the favour of the gods, and Remus is a bit upset by this, quite reasonably, and gets killed. We won't have much to say about Remus, so I won't go into that. And Romulus gets on with the business of founding the city. He produces a constitution, and the texts have a lot to say about his different arrangements for society and for organizing it and for legal issues. Then he increases the population, because he's only had a small band of people in order to get the city started, and he needs more. And one way he acquires more is through the episode of the Sabine women, which we shall come to. Like most Romans, he wins some wars. And then, rather surprisingly, he ends up as a bit of a tyrant, and he, according to some accounts, he actually gets killed by the senators. Though other accounts say that he's just whooshed off to heaven by a god who thinks that his time is up. It's very easy, when one does comparativism, to think of masses and masses of differences. If you go through the dossier piece by piece, you can always find a difference. So it's almost pointless treating differences in any exhaustive fashion. There are always masses of them. But for a start, one could note the whole setting is obviously different. It's in a different place. The names are different, a different sort of period of time. That Bhishma is not a king, and that's emphatically the case. Romulus is, on the other hand, a king, not only a king, but the king, the first king. Bhishma is not in any sense, I think one could say, a founder of anything. He's not doesn't found anything. He does his best to carry on the dynasty, but he's not a founder, and that is exactly what Romulus is, founder of the world's greatest empire, as the Augustan historians put it. Bhishma has nothing to do with wolves or indeed any other animals that might help him. On the whole, the goody-baddie point, what I was thinking of is that Bhishma fights quite long and hard, 10 whole days, more than any other marshal, for the baddies, the Kauravas, led by Duryodhana, the arch baddie. Whereas Romulus is, on the whole, presented by the Romans as a good thing, and indeed by the Greek historians who wrote about him too, as a good thing, in spite of, and they're rather embarrassed by it, this period of tyranny towards the end of his life. And the death scenes are completely different too, and one could go on. But Now we get to the more interesting bit, the similarities. Both these heroes come towards the start of large bodies of narrative which must once have been oral. Bhishma is mentioned in chapter 57 of the first book of the Mahabharata, along with which is really where the plot starts, and his birth story is told not very long afterwards. So he's there, he's sort of in there right near the start, and there's pretty little to Roman pseudo-history, as it's called, before Romulus. What there is some speculations about different races that may have populated Italy before the foundation of Rome, and stuff which must have come from Greece because it's an adaptation of, the Aeneid material is incorporated, and that must be of basically Greek inspiration. So Romulus comes pretty close to the start of the oral tradition that must have pre-existed, the writing down of Roman history about 200, 210 by Fabius Pictor, who was the first person to write down any Roman history. Both of these characters are semi-divine, though on different sides. That's to say, Bhishma has a divine mother, Ganga, and Romulus has a divine father, Mars, in some accounts. There's one person who says it's Jupiter, but there's a lot of obscurity about that, so I can't put much emphasis on that fact. So both of them are semi-divine, but both of them also have links with a sovereign god. Although Dyaus, who is the god incarnate in Bhishma, although he's not sort of very obviously a sovereign in the Vedas, I think, the comparativists have usually assumed that Deus, the proto-god, was a sovereign god. And Romulus does, in fact, have a number of more convincing links with Jupiter. For instance, it's Jupiter who must be responsible for the augury, which the auspices which enable him to take power in the first place. And Romulus only wins victories by praying on a couple of occasions to Zeus. So he's quite closely associated with Zeus, before one even starts on more abstract arguments. Quite interesting, both of them have mothers which are associated with rivers, because Ganga is obviously associated with a river, and she drowns her children. Romulus's mother was a Vestal virgin called Rhea Silvia, and the Vestal virgins conduct a ritual in which they throw images, little straw images of men, into the river Tiber. So although we can't say precisely that Rhea Silvia does this, it's quite likely that she's the first Vestal that's mentioned in the history of Rome, and usually rituals are ascribed to the there is no one else to whom this ritual is ascribed, and usually rituals are ascribed to the first person who is relevant. Now I've got three points in italics, which are the ones I shall concentrate on, and so I'll come to them in a moment, but just point out that both of them end up as deities, in that Bhishma goes back to heaven and is said to be a Vasu again. It doesn't actually say, I think, that he becomes Dyaus again, but he becomes a Vasu again. And Romulus becomes Quirinus, the god. So there are quite a lot of similarities before one gets into the details. Right, now I'm going to talk about the heading opens a list. So we're looking at rows 1 and 2 in that sort of tabulation. And consider the marshals. We've mentioned that Bhishma is the first marshal. He's followed by Drona, book 7, Karna, book 8, Shalya, book 9, and Ashvatthaman in book 10. And these are all Senapatis, they're all definitely marshals, even though, as we shall see, Ashvatthaman is rather an aberrant one. Of these five marshals, there are no more than five, it's definitely a pentad. The middle three all die on the battlefield, and their deaths are described at some length. Whereas the two extreme ones, Bhishma and Ashvatthaman, both survive the battle. Bhishma, as we've said, on his bed of arrows for a couple of months. Ashvatthaman, apparently for 3,000 years, that's the length of time to which Krishna condemns him, curses him to wander the earth. But consider the core marshals. Drona is a Brahman, and he's incarnation of the god Brihaspati, who's chaplain of the gods. Karna is by no means a Brahman. There's a lot to say about him, and all I'll say for the sake of brevity is that he's the arch enemy of Arjuna. He's Arjuna's most dangerous foe, I think. So he's certainly quite a good candidate for the F2 column qua warrior. Shalya is associated with the third function in a number of different ways. Firstly, Dumézil showed that in his analysis of types of marriage, you know, the list of eight types of marriage in Manu, Dumézil analysed the list, and he showed that the Asura mode involving the bride giver receiving a bride price, this mode was associated with the third function. It's a rather non-prestigious form, as you might expect. He's also a great lover of luxury, which is to say of wealth, because he sets out intending to fight for the Pandavas, who after all are his nephews, but he is seduced by the wealthy and luxurious pavilions which are supplied for him by Duryodhana. So he loves luxuries. He's also supplies his sister Madri to Pandu via a bride price mode of marriage. And Madri is the mother of the two twins who are incarnations of the Ashvins, and Dumézil has very strong arguments showing that the Ashvins themselves and the twins are both representatives of the third function. For instance, the twins become Vaishyas when they have to choose their disguise in the year 13. So much for the core marshals. Well, as I say, both the extreme marshals stand apart from the core in that they survive the battle, and clearly Bhishma is highly valued. He's regarded as, he's referred to constantly as the grandfather. His advice is normally heeded. Bhishma listens to him for nearly 2 months discoursing. He's highly valued. Ashvatthaman, on the other hand, is cursed by Krishna, ends up with leprosy, wandering the world solo. I mean, he's obviously a sort of outcast at the end of book 10. As for the kings, row 2, Consider again the core kings, all of whom are mortal. Numa is extremely given to religious activity. He doesn't fight any wars in a reign of 40 years. All he does is found priesthoods and demonstrate his piety. He has a special goddess that he consorts with and takes advice from. Tullus, in contrast, does practically nothing but fight wars throughout his reign. He despises religion until the very last few weeks of his life when he falls ill, but he's incapable of carrying on religious activity effectively. And he is really quite straightforwardly a warrior figure, as Dumézil also showed us. Ancus is somewhat difficult to analyse. He does a lot of building, and the sources are not very explicit about... they don't characterise him that clearly, but his reign is associated with a considerable increase in the demography and the demographic mass of Rome and in the wealth of its citizens. So I've suggested growth-oriented. Whereas the two founders in... the two extreme figures in row two, or the two extreme positions, are occupied on the one hand by Romulus, whom we needn't say more about, obviously highly valued. On the other hand, this interesting triad consisting of Tarquin the Elder, called Tarquin I here, Servius Tullius, and Tarquin the Second, Tarquin the Proud. So we've got Servius flanked by two Tarquins, who, according to some Roman historians, were originally one figure, but I think that's probably wrong, actually. Anyway, there are the two Tarquins flanking Servius. And Servius, what's interesting about him is that his name is quite unambiguously connected by the Romans with servus, meaning a slave. He is a slave king, which is very odd, really, to have a slave king in your history. He's quite a good man and so on, but he's a slave. And this is quite a striking fact. Now, if you focus on Servius, he too is semi-divine, like Romulus. And what I would suggest is that the triad in the Roman case corresponds to the fact that Ashvatthaman, although he's said to be Marshal Senapati of the army, actually only has two accomplices, two fellow soldiers. So there's a triad in the Sanskrit and a triad in the Latin tradition, but the Latin tradition has, it as it were, promoted the flanking figures, whereas the Sanskrit hasn't. It's just got them present. In both cases, just as Ashvatthaman is expelled at the end of his career, so Tarquin is expelled from Rome. But the similarity really rests quite considerably, not so much on the one-to-one links, let's say Shalya and Ancus, they're not particularly similar, but on the way they fit together into a classificatory schema, the pentadic schema. Right, so I move on to the multiphase career. Here, the analysis is less straightforward, it has to be said, because the careers are not sort of divided up in the nice, sharp way that one king or one marshal is separated from its neighbour, his neighbour. Nevertheless, the people's careers, the two comparanda, the two people to be compared, have careers that fall into phases. certainly in Bhishma's case, the last phase of being a marshal in the army is quite a distinct phase, and nothing in his previous career sort of really leads one to expect it, except perhaps it's foreshadowed in the raid on the Matsya kingdom. Right, so are there phases in Bhishma's career that fit the pattern? Well, Bhishma is, as we know, the incarnation of Dyaus. And my suggestion is that the first phase of Bhishma's career is his pre-birth phase in heaven. And this is not just a heavenly existence without incident, because while he's in heaven, he, with the other Vasus, is wandering through the forest, and he becomes involved in the theft of a Vasishtha's cow, and it's because of that that he is cursed to spend a whole lifetime on earth, whereas his brothers, who are less closely involved in the theft, only spend a few hours or days of infancy on earth. So he has, in this period of his life, I think it's his life, an episode in which he is blamed for stealing cattle. After his birth, we recall he is taken away by his mother for education, and it's emphasized that a lot of this consists in studying his Vedas. Moreover, during this first part of his life, he's not known as Bhishma, he's known as Devavrata, having a vrata to the devas, I mean, dedicated to the gods. He only gains the name Bhishma when he renounces the throne. Then there's the next two entries in the Bhishma row are somewhat complicated in that they are in the wrong order. That's to say, you could, if you liked, draw one of those marks which show that you've got to switch over the order of two words in the table, see, because the continuity, his work in ensuring the continuity of the dynasty, starts before his fight with Rama. That is to say, his work in ensuring the continuity of the dynasty is his trip to Benares to abduct the Benares princesses. And we mentioned that one of the princesses is already engaged, and she ends up extremely angry with him and gains the help of Parashurama to try and kill him. But Parashurama fails, but they have a 23-day battle, which is described at considerable length. So the ordering of the phases is not too clear. Let me not try and make it seem easier than it is. And indeed, the Rama element is set within his career as a matchmaker. So there are certain complications there, but if you look just at the beginning and the end, it's fairly straightforward, the analysis is. But let's move to, because the last phase, he's obviously very negatively valued. He's possessed by Danavas, demons, and he champions a tyrant, that is Duryodhana. Now, in Romulus's case, we don't have a pre-birth episode. I mean, Rome, there's no question of incarnation here, so that the story has to start with his human birth. But one of the things that does emerge is that his childhood, all the time up until the moment when he becomes a founder of Rome with the auspices, he is working, he's being brought up by herdsmen and is involved in cattle thefts himself and in fighting other cattle thieves. So the first phase of his life is involved in that. I've put kingship, which is perhaps not a very helpful entry. My point is that that's really the divide that separates off the first period. Once he's gone through the auspices, obtained kingship, then we get a whole chunk of text which is quite well segregated in all our three main sources, dealing with his constitutional, political and religious activities. Then we get the Sabine War, and again in this row the F2 and F3 elements come in the opposite order to the one you might expect, but it fits quite well with the Sanskrit. That is to say, he's involved in the abduction of the Sabine women first, and then there's a very well segregated section at the end of his life, just before he becomes a tyrant, when he wins three wars and wins and has some triumphs. Then, as we know, he becomes a tyrant at the end. So I think they probably, or in spite of the fact that there's a certain amount of blurring, I think the general shape of their careers conforms to the fivefold pattern. And finally, in I'm dealing with arranges brides for others. Bhishma, as we know, goes to the Svayamvara gathering at Kashi, and he abducts by force these three princesses, lifting them onto his chariot. But it turns out that the eldest princess, Amba, is already engaged to Shalva, and when she admits this to Bhishma, he lets her go. And then Shalva turns her down, saying that she's been abducted and he no longer wants her, and therefore she becomes very bitter and eventually plays a part in getting him killed. Anyway, Bhishma lifts the girls onto his chariot, and there is that is followed by scenes of violence when the other Kshatriya gathered at the Svayamvara fight him, including Shalva. There's reference to the fact that the two surviving, the two princesses who remain in Hastinapura, actually have a proper wedding. Then then comes the episode, I suggest, of Rama, though there are complications, which is a 23-day duel ended by the mediation of Ganga and some rishis. If we turn to the Roman material, there is a gathering, a ceremonial gathering in Rome, called a consualia, a feast in honour of Consus, which involves chariot races. So here too we have a chariot. Some of the sources say that there were precisely 30 maidens who were abducted, who gave their names to the curia, i.e. 3 times 10. But other sources say there were more, several hundred. But among those abducted was Hersilia, who is apparently, according to some accounts, is the a mother of a nubile young lady who decides to come of her own accord. So one of those abducted stands apart as having a separate status. Then, after the abduction, it's not just a matter of hanging on to the Sabine women, keeping them until they accept it. There is a proper formal marriage, a confariatio. There follow various wars, including the Sabine War, which is ended by the mediation of the women, corresponding, I think, to Ganga mediating in the case of the battle with Parashurama. So my conclusion is that Bhishma is cognate with Romulus and derives from a proto-narrative figure who is associated with Deus, the proto-god, and that even if little bits and pieces of history, names, locations may have been incorporated, the essential mass of detailed events in the careers of these two individuals go back to a proto-narrative and were not invented either in India or in Italy. Thank you.
Thank you. Very full presentation, so many levels of detail. We have about 20 minutes. Comments, questions? I have one to start, if you don't mind. And it's I'm not enough into this material to deal with the details very well, but the last comment you make, neither hero was invented in his homeland, and the sense that this is all from somewhere else, in a way is the history of these civilizations are from outside the places in which these stories are told, and in a way this militates against some kind of chauvinism or extreme patriotism in any of these cultures, because the great tales come from elsewhere. But I'm wondering if anything can be said about what you say vaguely at the top, the date and place of the proto-language culture is still controversial. Mm-hmm. Is that sort of a permanently controversial situation, such that it's a kind of myth in itself that somewhere else is the origin of all these civilizations outside themselves? Or is there some kind of a basic story, you know, neither Bhishma nor Romulus, but some other figure somewhere else whose memory is being kept alive? Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, I presume as regards names, the proto-figure, I call him the proto-figure, would have had some different name. I'm deliberately rather vague and perhaps even a little confused on the question of what elements belong to gods and what elements belong to heroes, because I think there's probably a good deal of interplay between them. And I haven't sorted out in my own mind whether I want to attach all these narrative events to a proto-god or a proto-hero. But in any case, I think that proto-figure would have, probably be 4th millennium BC, probably north of the Black Sea, but it wouldn't make any difference to the argument if it wouldn't even really make any difference if all these nationalist people are right in India and said that the proto-narrative was told in India. It would mean I'd have to alter the last sentence. But all the linguists say that that really can't work because of things like nomenclature for flora and fauna. I mean, if the proto-Indo-Europeans lived in India, the vocab lexicon for flora and fauna shouldn't be as it is, that sort of argument. There are lots of other arguments people like Witzel know about. I haven't tried to master them all. So I think it's much more likely that the proto-figure and the proto-narrative come from outside India.
Could you say that the proto-figure, I'm thinking of people like Eliade or even a more popular level Campbell, that the proto-state is somewhere in the human consciousness, and there is no place.
No, I wouldn't say that. No, I reckon to be a historian.
Okay.
I mean,
this is a very interesting point, because I feel that these things are multi-layered. If you look at a mythical figure, I mean, from my influence, say somebody in Spenser, in the Faerie Queen or something, he can be all these things. He can be an accretion of a number of attributes, so that some will be borrowed from other cultures and some will be native. And that the idea that one has to be wrong or right, if you think of a figure like Una in The Faerie Queen, she's an incorporation of all sorts of aspects, both of local goddesses concerned with unification and classical, because obviously Spencer's very well read. And the idea, I found it very odd when I came to it, Indology, that people seem to think of things in terms of being right and wrong. Because it's not how one would think of it in terms in a literary context.
In
English literary context. Sorry.
Yes, well, it's
the
question
is that you can have an accretion of.
Yes.
Because I felt that. That what you said was very convincing, but didn't nonetheless invalidate. I mean, clearly in the case of fauna, there isn't it. There is something that's quite clearly historically moving around. Yeah. Anyway, that was just something
that's an interesting point.
You know, because I was thinking of figures like well, Guyon with his fivefold star and things of the night, and in Spenser's Faerie Queen. There are a lot of figures in British mythology, which are
certainly. I've always been sort of slightly worried about sort of the Campbell, Eliade, Jung approach, in that I don't think.
I wasn't taking that. Yes. Yeah.
Well, okay, but I still perhaps ought to make the point that I don't think comparative work has advanced far enough to sort of engage these issues on a worldwide scale, because. No, even in Indo-European, the most studied of all the language families, we've sort of we're only sort of hopefully beginning to discover what's there. If you look at Australian Aboriginal mythology, Bushman mythology, Eskimo, even Tibeto-Burmans, I think my thesis was on Tibeto-Burman myths. You know, people haven't done the work. Mm. It's not easy to get grants for that sort of thing. It's not the most obvious sort of career move for people early on. And you know, so it'll be years before we're anywhere near knowing what the human spirit produces in different parts of the world and being able to generalise, I think. But maybe that doesn't quite meet your point, that perhaps I'm being a bit too sort of...
Oh, no, I didn't mean that you were, but yeah. when you said that some people would criticise you for being wrong,
that
I felt that the other... Yeah. And perhaps English literature is a bit more sophisticated in that regard, that it is used to a number of different ideas and would be happy to incorporate...
Well, notions such as a founder, I mean, that sort of notion... is terribly general, and one might say that something of that sort was universal, but then one would say that, well, Bhishma isn't really a founder. It's quite difficult to see what would be universal, isn't it? I mean, if you read Aboriginal mythology from Australia, it's so different in character from Indo-European that people who talk about universal folklore just do not know this stuff.
I really wasn't talking about
you.
No, I really want to stress that.
I wasn't.
So the temptation of equating the cognates leads one to compare Romulus with Rama, the hero of the Ramayana, rather than with Bhishma. Well, Bhishma was never a king, as we see, but Rama was king. And the kingship, constitution, wars, growth, all those things which you have mentioned, are common to both. Rama was also, in a sense, the founder, because he founded what is known as the Rama Rajya, which is hailed as the best form of kingship even today. Well, then, just as we have Romulus and Remus, the twins, we have Rama and Lakshmana. Remus dies, Lakshmana almost dies in the battlefield, but is revived. But again, we have the twins, Lava and Kusha, in the Ramayana. And as I see, the kings like Numa and others, that they followers of Romulus after him?
Yes, they're followers in the sense of successors.
And Kusha and others followed the other kings, whereas in the case of Bhishma, we cannot say they were actual his sons and others, no.
No, they're not generational successors.
Yes.
Though there are some interesting...
Well, in the case of both Rama and Romulus, there is some divine element. And both of them seem to have some difficulty in the early life. Rama also spends 14 years in the forest. There is abduction in both the episodes.
Mm.
So considering all these things, I find that comparison between Bhishma and Romulus is rather laborious and contrived, whereas that between Rama and Romulus seems to be rather natural and spontaneous.
Good. Well, I look forward to seeing this case argued at length. I mean, it's not impossible by any means that we have two Sanskrit cognates for one Roman one. I mean, it wouldn't really surprise me terribly. there's just so much work to be done in this field that hasn't been done. I don't actually think that you get quite so far with Romulus and Rama because, well, for one thing, you don't have the Deus connection, which is sort of etymologically guaranteed and really cast iron. But then the connection between Jupiter and Romulus is not that strong, so perhaps I shouldn't emphasise that one too much. But I think the whole network, I don't think you'd have such a dense network, but I could be wrong, and I urge you to explore it.
Just on that,
one other small point.
Just before you get to your second point, just what would be your view of the status of the Ramayana in the Indo-European context? I mean, the Mahabharata, you make so many cases in what you've written. Would the Ramayana then be an indigenous Indian?
Well, no, I think I haven't written much on it, but there's a lot to be said for the view that that the Ramayana belongs in the Mahabharata, I think. I mean, or certainly belongs to the same set of things. After all, if one looks at Homer, sort of the first thing that strikes one about the Trojan War, really, in comparison with India, is its abduction of a beautiful woman, as the Ramayana is. And although you've got an abduction scene with Draupadi, it's very small. It's not the sort of central motif in the Mahabharata. So I'm sure there are things to be done comparatively with the Ramayana.
Yes, I'm sorry to interrupt.
One other small point. You said Bhishma arranges for the impregnation of the wives of Chitravinaya.
Yes.
As I understand it, it's rather Satyavati who arranges for it. Bhishma agrees to it.
Yes, okay. That's probably a slight inaccuracy. I mean, they do it, they often act in conjunction, don't they? Yes, it's she who summons him, that's quite right. I can't remember exactly who says what to whom, but I think they're both quite closely connected. And it's he who, I mean, he's the important figure, partly because of this three-generation business. Perhaps I'll say a little about that, because it's quite fun. I mean, he arranges his father's marriage, his brother's marriage, and his three nephews' marriages, but not any more. And the reason this is so interesting is that Dumézil had compared Bhishma with Heimdall, and Heimdall in the Edda, in the Rigsthula, one of the Eddic poems, is active in three successive generations. He first goes to the house of great-grandfather and great-grandmother, and after he's there, it's not quite clear what he does, whether he impregnates himself or not. Probably not. There is born the first slave and the ancestor of the slaves, the thralls, I think they're called. Then he goes to the house of grandmother and grandfather and gives rise to the first churls, the first farmers. And then he goes to the house of father and mother and gives rise to the first earls, that's the warriors. And then he stops. He doesn't go any further, although he takes an interest in the next generation. So Bhishma has that three generation of marriage organizing activity, if we say, rather than strictly arranging, and so does Heimdall. And Dumézil didn't quite make that point, so I've got another paper coming up, not yet written, on the Rigsthula.
Yes, Reverend.
Could you speak up? I'm a bit deaf.
Bhishma is identified as an incarnation of Vyasa.
Yes.
But also as one of Vasu.
Yes.
Now the Vasus seems they're sort of a group of gods.
Yes.
Who are they? And are they in any way related to Vyasa?
Well, I'm a bit puzzled by them. There are eight of them, always. they quite often occur in a list with 8 Vasus, 11 Rudras, and 12 Adityas, which adds up, is it to 31, and then the extra 2 to make up the 33 gods are supplied sometimes by Dyaus and Prithvi, sometimes by I forget who else. There are various possible ways to fill up the number to 33. So they belong in that triad, which Dumézil sort of toyed with interpreting that as a trifunctional triad. I don't really know what to make of it. The Mahabharata does give 8 names for the Vasus, none of them, incidentally, being Dyaus. although it also says that Bhishma is a Vasu, when it gives the 8 names, it doesn't include him. And that is explicable, though, because one of the variant stories about the birth of Bhishma says that in one of the variant stories, each of the 8 Vasus agrees to put aside 1/8 of the semen that has generated them, Shantanus, to produce a 9th.